construction workers got a surprise recently while laying a pipeline underneath Lake Lucerne in central Switzerland. On the lake floor, they found the traces of a prehistoric village. This finally confirmed a long-standing theory among archaeologists, who believed that people lived in the area thousands of years ago. But the question is, why were the traces of their home so deep within the lake? In other regions, you find sites like this along the shoreline. And how do archaeologists manage to unravel prehistoric findings underwater? Today on The Swiss Connection, we'll get to the bottom of this. I'm your host, Susan Masika. This is a tuning fork, which is used for tuning musical instruments. In case you've never seen one, it's a U-shaped piece of metal that you can make vibrate by banging it against a surface, and it'll resonate at a constant pitch. And what does this tuning fork have to do with pile dwellers? Our video journalist, Michele Andina, will tell us all about it. Hey, Michele, thanks for joining.
Hi, Susan.
So, Michele, you accompanied a group of archaeologists on Lake Lucerne with your camera. And it sounds like you had a great day out. Tell us, who did you meet and what did you see?
Well, I was really lucky. After a rainy summer, it was one of the first sunny days and kind of perfect to go on a boat ride. The goal was to find out more about the remains of pile dwellings underneath Lake Lucerne.
Now, when you say pile dwelling, I'm picturing a primitive house on stilts, basically. Is that a pretty accurate mental image?
Well, I'm not sure if primitive is the right word, but yes, I'm also thinking of huts built on piles to keep people safe from floods and wild animals. Anyway, over several weeks, Lucerne's archaeology department navigated the lake, moving in parallel lines in 10 meters apart. They're creating a map of the lake's topography and the spots of prehistoric sites. And to do this, they used a special device they called the fish.
Now, what the heck is that?
This is an echo sounder, a device that looks a bit like a yellow life buoy and floats in water next to the boat. On one hand, it emits sound into the lake. On the other hand, it records the echo reflected from the lake bottom. The data is fed to a computer, which instantly turns it into an image on the laptop. When I was on the boat, I met Ole Grön. He's from the University of Copenhagen, and he's the guy who developed this procedure.
The computer part of our system processes the signal so that we actually get a very precise picture of what is in the seafloor. So it is being converted into a profile, a long profile with the surface of the water on the top, and then the water, we can see the water face as we call it, then the top of the seafloor with vegetation. Sometimes we can see the vegetation even though it's very ephemeral. And then we can see into the sediment, which is below the seafloor or the lake floor in this case. And we can see poles, we can see larger stones, rocks that are there. Oh yeah, shipwrecks. We see shipwrecks pretty well.
So did I understand this correctly? Using this noise, they can actually see, well, hear, what's under the floor of the lake?
Yes, indeed. And interesting about this noise is that it's a sequence of chirps, which are sent out at a rate of 16 times per second. When set to a slower rate, you can actually hear the chirps. Chirp, that's also the name of the system, which Ole tells me is used for all kinds of things. But he was the first one to use it in this way.
The normal echo sounders you have on ships, their main purpose is simply to define the top of the seafloor. For the chirp, the main purpose is to penetrate into the seafloor. And what you can see will depend on the frequency. The chirp system uses a whole band. It starts with 2 kilohertz and goes up to 20 kilohertz. So that's why when it sends out a signal, it sounds like a bird singing. And that's why it's called a chirp. Because the objects we look for, they are, you know, a pole is 20, 30 centimeters in diameter. The hull of a wreck is not very thick. So we have to be able to catch quite fine details to be able to see these things. The lower your frequency, your better penetration. But your resolution will be a bit coarser, 10 centimeters or more. But when you come up to the high end, about 20 kilohertz, you will get a better resolution, but you will not get such a good penetration. So you actually optimize the outcome, and then you can, when you interpret it, you can take out the best parts of the signal.
But what CHIRP is really great at is finding man-made stone tools. And here we get to the tuning fork.
Now, I was wondering when we were going to get to that.
The pieces of flint napped by humans and also other kind of siliceous mineral napped by humans.
For those who aren't familiar with this term, napping is the process of chipping off sharp pieces of stone from a larger piece.
They actually resonate within a frequency interval going from 3 to around 15, 16, 17, 18 kilohertz. And that means that they don't have exactly the same resonance frequency points. But when we sweep the interval, we actually excite all of them so that they start vibrating in the seafloor. They answer. They send back noise to us. We can hear, or our system can hear. So in principle, what happens when you remove pieces of flint and other siliceous rocks from a larger piece, you create a kind of a sound wave in the material. The same time as you remove it, you turn it into a tuning fork that resonates. So it will actually respond to you when you call with the right frequency.
Wow, that's amazing. It's like finding the needle in the haystack. So with these stone pieces resonating, was that his discovery then?
Well, he told me about his work as a young archaeologist on sites in Denmark in the early 80s. He was involved in a project doing archaeological survey on various areas before clearing them for the construction of a gas pipeline across the country. They failed to find all the sites that were there, and this started him thinking about methods. With his background in mathematics and physics, he soon thought about sound. But the key moment came when he was napping a piece of stone himself.
As a student of archaeology, I was specializing in Stone Age, so I had to be able also to nap flint myself. So I was experimenting, and I had some very good flint. And what was surprising was that I did not need to use a lot of force. I just had to touch the edge of this core, as we call it, the big piece I removed the sharp pieces from with my napping stone. And boing, they flew off. And after some time, I recognized that it actually gave me a pain in the ears. So I was collaborating with a guy who worked at the Bang & Olufsen Sound Lab, which was very, very prominent at that time. And he said, well, send me some real pieces and we'll test them. And I sent them to him, and Hugo Rasmussen, who is not a man of many words, he surprised me by calling me on the phone and speaking a lot. They had nearly smashed the receiver because the response from the first piece was so strong that they actually had to damp it. All of the pieces had actually responded strongly and returned very nice resonance peaks to them. So he was shocked, but also happy with the results, of course. He had never imagined it would be so strong.
It then took another 30 years for his idea to materialize. It was in Israel on a little survey on an underwater stone site in 2010 that he and his team got to apply the method for the first time. The acoustic response was enormous. Since then, Ole and his team used the method to sites in Israel, Denmark, Sweden, and of course Switzerland. Interpreting what the echo images actually showed wasn't easy at first. But by comparing the images to excavations carried out on the sites later on, interpretations became more accurate. And they did a lot of experiments too.
We simply filled a couple of bags with 14 kilos of, in one of them it was man-napped lithic pieces, and then the other one it was naturally cracked pieces, pieces that were produced by nature. Because in nature you also have a lot of stones and rocks cracked. And we choose the natural pieces so that they had shapes like the pieces humans had napped, very sharp and long pieces. And then we tested these two. We sailed over them with our chirp. And we got a strong response from the ones that were napped by humans, and we did not get any response from the naturally cracked ones. So it actually proved that it is a human signature that you get this noise signature from the lithic pieces.
Ole is also involved in developing an artificial intelligence system, which in a few years from now might be able to draw even more accurate conclusions from the images. He's convinced there will be increasing demand for these kinds of units in future.
If we go back to 2001, UNESCO made a statement, a document saying that we had to take more care of cultural heritage underwater, including Stone Age sites, because our commercial use of the sea areas is increasing. That has put a pressure on different countries to strengthen their management of cultural heritage underwater, and also in international waters, UNESCO wants some kind of procedure for protecting cultural heritage. And if you have to protect cultural heritage, a precondition is to detect the sites, because if you don't know where they are, you have a problem. What is very practical from an environmental point of view is that humans from their settlements will have been collecting plants, animals, fish, birds, etc., etc., and therefore very likely will have accumulated DNA from these creatures. And saline conditions actually seem to be very good for preservation of DNA, much better than on land. So the sites can actually function as a whole archive of the environment.
This reminds me of something that project leader Anna Kienholz was telling me right before we set off. For her, as the head of Lucerne's archaeology department and a real Stone Age specialist, pile dwellings are a real treat.
Ich bin Urgeschichtlerin und das ist für mich so meine Epoche, die Pfahlbauten. Also, und das Spannende an den Pfahlbauten ist natürlich die Erhaltung.
The exciting thing, she told me, is that organic elements have been preserved in water. Wooden tools, nets, baskets and so on. So in that respect, these sites convey a lot more than a settlement on land, where they can only find pieces of ceramics and stones. And then Anna also told me why pile dwellings in Lucerne are buried so deep in the lake, but in other regions you find them along the shoreline.
Der Vierwaldstättersee ist im Gegensatz zu den vielen anderen Seen in der Schweiz nicht gesunken, sondern gestiegen.
Unlike most other Swiss lakes, water levels on Lake Lucerne have not dropped, but risen over time. This is in part because of its geography, but also because of the dams on the River Reuss in medieval times, which were used to power mills. Archaeologists have suspected for a long time that there are traces of Lucerne's prehistoric past somewhere, And now they're finding them at the bottom of the lake.
Yeah, it's true. I think when a lot of people think of archaeology, they think about people out in the sand or dust, and they're digging around with little paintbrushes cleaning off bits. But here it's quite different, of course, if it's underwater. And I was reading that actually Switzerland has hundreds of pile dwelling sites.
Well, let's hear what the expert Andreas Mader knows about it. He's the head of Zurich's underwater archaeology department and is also involved in the Lucerne project.
Well, we have about half of the Central European pile dwelling sites are at the Swiss lakes. So that is around 500 sites in Switzerland only. And they cover a time span of 3,500 years, starting around 4,300 BC and ending at around 800 BC. So the corresponding ages, the pile dwelling ages, are called Neolithic and Bronze Age pile dwelling. But of course, there are other Neolithic and Bronze Age sites in other countries. For instance, in Germany, there are also many sites, or in Italy, France, also in Austria and in Slovenia. So these are the core countries with Neolithic and Bronze Age settlements.
And every 1 or 2 years, they find a new one. To me, that sounds really exciting. But I can imagine that it's not easy to actually secure and interpret the findings.
Yeah, it's really a case of, like on the boat, probing or feeling around and then trying to interpret the data.
So we want to make some mappings, see how many piles do we have. Sometimes there are hundreds and thousands of piles of one village, or even several phases represented in these piles. It's like a riddle, and we have to solve this to see when is the first house built, and how old are these phases and the villages, how did it develop, and so on. So that's a lot of work, but we need more data, not only the non-invasive survey data. In the best case, we will make an excavation. So we need all the finds in the 3D context. So we want to know which find has been in what layer. We need the posts, the piles, the exact positions of all the finds and piles. So that's basically what we need. We also make photographical documentations. And with all this stuff, we make like a 3D reconstruction of the situation. Then you can start to investigate, and then you can start the research. And then, of course, you put it in the context. It's not only the piles and the prehistoric people that left their things, but it's also an environmental context. We also have climate data, like pollen, very small. You can't see it by your eye, but it gives you a hint. What climate has it been? How have the temperatures been, and so on? And you have, of course, much larger remains, like leaves or wood. You have bones from animals. So all this helps you to reconstruct not only the history of the people that lived there, but also the history, the natural history of this site.
So when will we know more about the ruins they found under Lake Lucerne? I can hardly wait to hear more.
Well, we'll have to be a bit patient. First results aren't expected until spring 2022, but we'll continue following the project.
Well, great. Keep us posted. And thanks for taking us along on your boat ride.
It was a pleasure.
And if you want to see the video that Michele shot, visit us at swissinfo.ch. That's where you'll also find many other stories about archaeological treasures found in Switzerland, the home of many UNESCO cultural heritage sites. The Swiss Connection is a SwissInfo production. If you'd like to get in touch with us, drop us a line down in the comments section, or you can send us an email at swissconnection@swissinfo.ch. This time we had video journalist Michele Andina in the double role of episode producer as well as composer of the theme music that you're hearing now. Our studio engineer is Donny Wheeler. Signing off for all of us, I'm Susan Masika. Thanks for listening.